Welcome, everybody. The podcast today is on the idea and practice of meditation. I'd like to start off with a few comments about how to listen to these podcasts that I'm doing. The thing to keep in mind is that I might be wrong, to always be asking yourself, is this right? How to find out what the best way forward is. The general idea behind the podcast is that everyone is better off carefully thinking on their own about their own life situation rather than relying on other people to give them direct guidance. Of course, input from other people is quite valuable in forming your own ideas. But the idea generally is to be skeptical and mistrust and think things out for yourself. So I present these ideas in that context. And quite interestingly, it's not far from the ideas of the Dalai Lama himself, who quite amusingly has intimated and even presented the idea that Buddhism itself can be thought of as an experiment rather than some truth etched in stone. Not to imply that this podcast will be on Buddhism. It isn't. It's much more about my own pursuit of the question what meditation is as a technique or a technology, trying to abstract away from all that's been said about meditation to what might be a generalization across what other people have found. So again, think of it in terms of Bertrand Russell's admonition that the greatest challenge in life is to know what is true. After all, it's an interesting question. I remember as a younger man reading that he had said that, and at that time, quite inexperienced as I was, I thought to myself, well, it's generally quite obvious what is true. But I later found out that that is not at all the case. It's quite difficult sometimes to know what is true. And one is reminded even that these days in our era of enlightenment, hopefully, and science, the review of scientific conclusions is finding that many, many studies need to be revised. That many, it's actually possible to observe that perhaps even the majority of studies are wrong. Now, this isn't to disparage science, because very often when there's wrongness, what was said needs adjustment rather than to need to be discarded. So, this is on meditation. The reasons for doing meditation are many and varied and different from person to person. For many, it's an experience. People pursue calmness in their lives. Some people are trying to get away from mental anguish. Leonard Cohen himself mentions that he doesn't think people would pursue something such as Zen Buddhism unless there was something really off, something really wrong in their psychological in their mentality, in their psychological well-being. That may or may not be true, but I'm sure it's true for some. Another reason is to pursue social empathy. After all, there's an honorable hypothesis that we're all better off if we attempt to understand the lives of others. In fact, the Buddha himself perhaps approached meditation in this way because as a protected young person, he hadn't experienced suffering or the implications of death. And when he came to have experiences that indicated these things existed out in the world, it led him to try to find what would be the answer to experiences of suffering, and that's often presented as a general motivation for practice in Buddhism. To can relieve suffering in all sentient beings. But also, you might be interested in meditation as a form of general inquiry, curiosity. What's going on? Everybody talks about mindfulness these days. Many people talk about mindfulness. It might be just your curiosity or scientific inquiry. Yes, you might want to increase empathy. But you might also notice that Buddhists and those who meditate regularly have more caring for animals, even insects. This just might interest you. How do people come to have this outlook of caring for others? Elsewhere, I'll be doing a podcast on Simone de Beauvoir, not as a feminist, but as a psychologist, where she makes what I claim is the most major discovery in psychology in the last 200 years. And that has to do with penetrating the perspective of others, so-called objectification, as an obstacle. So who pursues meditation? Very often it's those who've confronted unhappiness. Not necessarily depressed people, but those who see suffering perhaps have faced the problem of death early and might have some overlap with the experiences of the Buddha. It might seem grandiose to seek to remove the suffering for all sentient beings. But then again, we remember during the Vietnam War, there was a Buddhist priest who shook the whole world, raised awareness, no doubt had a psychological effect on everyone watching the daily news worldwide when he sat and immolated himself just as a representation of his unhappiness with the suffering that was occurring. It's quite an interesting topic. But beyond these various motivations for thinking about meditation, I claim that I'm interested in the possibility or the fact for me that there's a general human problem, which can be summarized, where should you put your mind? Day to day, your mind is taken here and there. You fall into cycles of unproductive thought. Everyone does it. You might find that you're consumed with social media. You might find that you're consumed with negative thoughts. You might find you're consumed with so much dreaming about things you could do that you never do anything. There is this general question in human existence: where should you put your mind, and how do you do it? Most people have no concept of putting your mind somewhere, and this is the essence of meditation: learning about the possibility that you can have control, partial and even to increasing extents, over where you put your mind. Incidentally, this is related to the essence of cognitive behavioral therapy. It's very different in a way, but in case you are interested in your mental well-being or that of others, it's been found that cognitive behavioral therapy can be as effective often as psychotropic medications for psychological discomfort and difficulties. Not to make any recommendation here, I think what psychologists have found is the combination of cognitive behavioral therapy and medications is sometimes the best. So not to push that point too far, but it is a further illustration that you may want to consider, is there value in learning how to have some personal control over where you put your mind? This is not a new idea. A frightening aspect of it is even electroshock, where upsettingly, some psychiatrists find benefit in using electric shock to erase some of memory, so the places you put your memory begin from at least partially a clean slate. That's not an authoritative professional description, but there's an analogy there that you might want to consider. But less stark, perhaps, there are other comparisons that you might consider. What is the relationship between Zen meditation or any meditation and Catholic prayer? The repetition, the concentration, the devotion of heart in prayer, not just Catholic prayer, but in many kinds of prayer in many religions, many sects, bears similarities to to the type of meditation that's independent of religion. But there are overlaps. Thomas Merton, the famous intellectual of several decades ago, was so taken by interlocutions and discussions with Eastern philosophy meditators that I would say that even his practice became bifurcated, where he maintained, for the most part, a devotion to Catholicism, but also wholeheartedly adopted a relationship to meditation practice. And that raises an interesting point, because many have observed that Buddhism might not be defined as a religion in the way that some other religions are. There are clearly differences. Without getting into that, we could still observe, perhaps usefully here, that meditation is fundamentally ecumenical. It's a part of many religious and shamanic practices, and it is not a religion. My interest is in meditation as a technique, or actually a technology. Now, there are effects in religious. So people who are high achievers in this idea of having the mind become aware of mind and detaching oneself from all the distractions and being able to practice enlightenment at a deep level. I hesitate to use the word achievement, because that can work against effective meditative practice. But folks who are very deep into meditative practice, let's put it that way, can often have a kind of charisma. The most famous of the Vietnamese Buddhist practitioners has a lot of personal charisma. The Dalai Lama has a lot of personal charisma. There are even folks who feel that the best way to influence the world is not through mass political action. I'm not taking a position on this, but there are people who believe that the best thing to do is to develop yourself into a form of inspiration to others and let that spread. So there are many angles from which one can view meditation. One very interesting one these days, when China appears to have some separation from traditions elsewhere in the world, is to go back and look for inspiration and heartfelt admiration for the Chan Buddhism that existed in the mountains of China from the Tang Dynasty and even before. Scholars such as Red Pine, a Westerner, and others have investigated this and discovered, in fact, that the meditation hermits in the mountains of China have likely always been there, practicing their approach to learning about their own human mind for centuries and centuries. And so there's this intersection among that segment of Chinese experience and all of the Western interest in mindfulness. Well, those are some general characterizations. Another approach to understanding the meditation, to understanding the meditation, sorry, I'm resetting my notes here. Understanding the meditation world is to think about all of the stories, the anecdotes about meditation. There are so many of them. They're so rich. They're so entertaining. We might just reflect on a few of these by way of introduction to the lofty areas, the lofty kinds of thinking that meditation might take you to. A reference, by the way, is the koans in the what's known as the Blue Cliff Record, which is an attempt to take all of the mental puzzles used in early Chan and Zen to get practitioners to drop all of the intellectual interference that comes in from everyday thinking and work their way toward the desired meditative state. If you read through the Blue Cliff Record, you'll find many interesting anecdotes and many puzzles presented to you that will truly puzzle you. It will puzzle you because there is no rational solution, but you will find quickly that the purpose of them is to get you to give up on rational, linear, kind of off-the-wall thinking in your everyday life. I won't go into that in more detail. Well, let's talk about a couple of examples. One example is in a certain monastery, there were two monks fighting over a cat. They both laid claim to this cat. So the enlightened leader, who was the main inspiration in the monastery, saw reduction and absurdism in this wasteful thought process. Whose is the cat? Who owns the cat? For whom is the cat? So he simply said, well, why don't you folks decide this? If not, I have a solution. We'll simply cut the cat in half and we'll give half to each of you. Now that's an upsetting and some will think a poor example, but it brings you very quickly to the idea that your everyday thought processes may lead nowhere or to destructive conclusions or whatever if you follow them through, and that solutions sometimes come in just letting go of that. The idea being, let go of that and you'll be left with appreciation of the cat and the problem can dissolve. So wasteful thought processes are a constant focus of those trying to learn meditation, the object being to get rid of them. The objective in meditation is to push your mind where the intellectual options fall away. You'll hear folks talking about dualism, making distinctions, maintaining categories. Here's another anecdote that you'll encounter if you undertake reading about these subjects. One of the most respected Chan leaders in a monastery said to imagine yourself hanging by a rope from a cliff. There you are hanging. You've got both hands on the rope. But the nature of the rope is it requires two hands to hold on. And you're desperate, and you look around. Your mind is obviously focused. And you turn your head and you see a couple feet away, there's a strawberry, a beautiful, luscious strawberry. And you think to yourself, there's nobody around to help me. The rope is such that I cannot climb up and I cannot go down. I'm stuck here. I have two choices. I can hang on, in which case I'm doomed, or I can reach for the strawberry, in which case I have the strawberry, and then I'm doomed. So this is a call to presence of mind, actually evaluating where your mind is and what your options are, and deciding whether just hanging on to a rope, bemoaning the situation, negative thoughts, reflecting that there's no you're doomed, there's no outcome other than disaster. What is the alternative? Well, perhaps you look for whatever positive experience is available to you. I don't want to push these anecdotes too far as analogies into real life. They have their limitations, but they also have quite a bit of power. The next antidote is actually at the origination of the of Buddhism. Of course, Buddha sat under the Bodhi tree and he achieved enlightenment. Took him such a long time. He diminished his body. He really worked very, very hard. Then had a more moderate attitude. Just worked very, very hard. But he achieved what he found to be the solution to suffering in the world. Excuse me. And then, at the end of his days, the question came of how he would pass the tradition on. He had to pick his first disciple. And to this day, there's a tradition of formally passing on discipleship. So he presented a question to an audience of acolytes, to an audience of his followers, to see who might have an answer that would inspire him to believe that this is the person to carry on the tradition. And there were various attempts at verbal responses. And here's the key point. One person in the audience didn't offer a verbal response, but simply held up a flower. And he was chosen. So there again, that gives us a hint what meditation is about. It's perceiving the opportunity, the beauty even, the constructiveness, the clean opportunity of whatever is around you. It is a very constructive process. We could continue to another story that's told about Steve Jobs' master. Now, I don't want to claim that Steve Jobs was himself a master, or I don't even know how accomplished he was, because he is known for an interest in Buddhism, in Zen Buddhism, but also there are stories of how well he treated people he worked with, even if for good purpose. He can sometimes, if you just look at documentaries and things, he can seem driven. But he had a master who was quite a good communicator. And let me explain what I mean by that with another anecdote. As people realized that Steve Jobs' master was available in the California area, there was a request for him to do a public presentation, which he agreed to, and he did it down by the sea, overlooking the Pacific. One imagines Big Sur, although I don't think it was there. And he had a very large audience, and they were all there watching for a particular event, because this master had pursued archery as a Zen practice. Now, of course, this is well known, the famous book Zen and the Art of Archery by Eugen Herigel is quite well known. So people were so interested to see this Zen master take his bow and shoot at the target. Just to, once again, meditators can have a lot of personal charisma, and they were interested in observing this person for the charisma he must have had to influence Steve Jobs, who kind of has a following in tech circles, etc., in technological circles. What Jobs' master did was take an arrow, put it in the bow. He drew it back very serenely with the charisma we were talking about. He let go of the arrow and fired it, and it missed the target by a lot, which must have created quite an interesting reaction in the crowd. I'm not sure that's been reported. But what's particularly amusing about this event is, having done that, he then turned to the crowd and he said, "Bullseye," which helps one to understand that the purpose of meditation is not the same as being driven toward a particular goal. It's on another level. So the bullseye is not hitting the target, but it's in the psychological experience. Archery is interesting in this regard. It's even quite fun to read Eugen Herigel's book, at least up to the point where he talks about the beginning of his training, because with regard to not having goals and having a different orientation to one's mind and where one puts one's mind, it's quite amusing when you learn that when Eugen went into the training program, it was 2 years before they gave him an arrow. The first 2 years were learning to draw the bow, even to draw the bow without drawing the bow, which once again takes away the concept of goal orientation. That book is an anecdote in itself. You can read about the experience. An anecdote that I particularly am fond of also has to do with a Chan. Chan is the Chinese word from which the Japanese word Zen derives, and it shows that Zen originates back in China. So perhaps my favorite anecdote has to do with, and you'll find out here in a little while why I'm so fond of this. This anecdote has to do with a young person coming to a monastery and wanting to join the monastery, become a novice monk and begin the training. That in itself is interesting. Very often novices are made to sit outside the gate for long, long periods to show that their level of interest is high enough that they have the dedication to the or the vocation for what they're setting out to do. But in this case, there was none of that. Instead, there was a novice approaching the monastery, but unclear where the entrance was. Unclear how to get in. He wanted to knock on the door and ask permission to join, but he couldn't find the door. So he was wandering around, and he came across a monk outside the monastery. And he said to him, I want to go knock on the door, but I can't find the entrance. How do you get in? And the monk says, I recommend that you enter by the sound of the river, which I find, this wouldn't strike you as being a monumental answer right away, but if you pursue a lot of study, as I've tried to do, and find a commonality in all meditation practice that has to do with not just listening, but putting your mind in the state of input as opposed to analysis. You might come back to this anecdote and see that it was a deeply insightful answer. The entrance is by the sound of the river. One doesn't know if the aspiring novice actually followed the river and didn't understand, or whether he got the irony and the subtleness of those of that direction. Another anecdote illustrates the concept of non-attachment. If in meditation one tries to avoid having one's mind attached to all the ideas that were kind of addicted or obsessed with, the things that force their way into our mind and occupy our time and our mind. If you think about that as a problem, you would quickly come to the conclusion that non-attachment to ideas is an important aspect of meditation practice. And there's a story. Some of these are intentionally shocking. Don't take them as sociological accounts of good practice by good human beings. They're meant to capture your mind. This one has to do, once again, with a Chan monk who lived in a mountain cabin not too far from the village. And word had it, there was a young, attractive woman that would come to visit. And she came back and forth. And one day she appeared, I believe with the parents, in the monk's little home and named the monk as the father and said, you know, I'm paraphrasing here, or I'm kind of making this up, but look what you've done to me. Look at the problem. This isn't a baby I wanted. He said, I don't want to raise this baby. You caused this baby, so we want you to take care of it. Anyway, the value of this part of the anecdote is the very simple response that the monk gave to the new young mother and the family, which was, okay then. And that shows that his intuition led him into a solution which was so natural and wholesome that there was no need for intellectual debate. He was just drawn into it in a very supportive way for the young woman. Well, that's only half the story, because sometime later, I don't remember if it's a year or two later, the woman recanted the story and said she had just been blaming the monk, and that the baby was not in fact his, and she wanted to raise it, and that was her baby. And so once again, the monk, who now had been raising the baby, was confronted in his little home with this new proposition that she wanted the baby back. And what's particularly significant about it was that there was no great intellectual debate again. His response this time, again, after no doubt having become devoted to and having probably fallen in love with the idea of raising the baby, was okay then. So this illustrates the possibility of non-attachment when there are things that are, I don't know if you'd say destined, but there are things that are seem good for the world. There's a way to go, but there's a lot of negatives, a lot of debate, considerations. This gentleman just very easily went with the flow, and you could see that there was a flow like water with his mind. Water down a stream might hit a rock. So it does, but it just moves and flows around it. So that concludes a number of anecdotes that a person might encounter that help to indicate what meditation might be about and indicate what some of the results might be in terms of personal psychology, and help to just guide an inquiry. And I just offer those as things that I happened upon myself. Now, what I want to do now is go on to the very clear, the very, very clear state of meditation in our modern world, where there is such a variety of approaches. There are so many approaches. And I want to talk about this in the context of my own idea to try and find out what they have in common, to try and find the intellectual core, the intellectual center. This is why I call meditation a technique or a technology. A lot of the folklore and stories, such as I've been told, there's a lot of culture surrounding the idea of meditation. But what is the nugget at the center of it all? I don't present myself as being any great guide to all of this. I actually find Sam Harris's Waking Up app quite excellent. A highly intellectual guy who walks through effective techniques quite effectively. There are other people who have tried to put together a reduction from all the complexities and differences and distinctions and disagreements in schools of meditation to try and simply a simple step-by-step approach that might be effective. In fact, the doctors, the MDs at University of Massachusetts Medical Center in Worcester, who are well known for something known as the relaxation response, where they have done just what I'm going to be talking about, try to find, take out all the religion, take out all the folklore, take out everything except the simple technique that's shared by many, many schools of meditation, and present it as an offering for people that want to get the benefits without entering into any of the cultural surroundings that one often finds. Transcendental meditation also attempts to get right to the nub, and has been used by many well-known people over the years to begin a practice of meditation. And we find commonalities everywhere we look. You'll find in many forms of meditation there's a focus on breathing, paying attention to your own breathing. Now, my own view of this is that by paying attention to breathing, you get your mind off of all of the distractions in life, but you still have yourself on an intellectual focal point. So it's a great, important stepping stone quite far along. Other forms of meditation focus on a sound such as or, as I mentioned earlier, a koan being an impossible to solve intellectual puzzle, which if you focus on it and focus on it, can by reputation cause you to transition to into a state of abandoning all of that intellectualization. Even karate, which I practiced for quite a while in my early years, the repetition of kata, until kata are the forms, the imaginary practice fights, which are really just, sometimes they call them structured calisthenics, but they're practiced over and over, the same ones, until it becomes unconscious muscle learning, a muscle learning challenge. You want things to become very, very automatic. And the concentration on a repeated action is much like the sound, or the breathing. Everybody has noticed commonality. What I'm trying to do here is not completely unique. What I think might be new, although you can never be sure of that, there's so many people in the world pursuing so many perspectives, is that I thought, against what everybody tells you, that intellectual study of it all might be productive. In other words, everybody says that you can't learn Zen, you can't learn yoga meditation, you can't learn any of these things, you can't learn the relaxation response by reading about it, you have to do it. Others say you really have to have a master to guide you. But the hypothesis has been that you don't make progress in something which is essentially non-intellectual. I won't say anti-intellectual. Booker Thomas Merton, a great intellectual of the last century, who was much dedicated to meditation. You know, folks view that as like paradoxical. How are you going to learn about something which is unintellectual by doing something intellectual? Well, I agree with that somewhat, but you do need to practice at some point. But the question is whether you could really make a lot of progress honing the whole thing down to a focus that you want to pursue, such that it would take much less practice to actually get somewhere. I started this whole, I started my interest in this by going to a Zen center here in Massachusetts. And I had an interesting experience because the instructor, supposedly an enlightened person, I have no doubt but what it was true, presented an intellectual question. We're sitting in a circle, and there was a bell sitting in the middle. He said, What is a bell? Before I actually get on to the upshot from this story, I'll just tell another little anecdote. There was somebody in that class who had been in Vietnam after the war, and she was a Buddhist, and many people wanted to get out of the, people from well-to-do families wanted to get away from the what they felt was socialist repression, which was, made their life very difficult. And the families would accumulate, they would all pitch in money from many different sources to finance getting one person out, and she benefited from this. The family put together a great fund for her to get out. And she knew one other person in another family who was going to go, so they agreed that they would go together just to be a little bit of a team. And she gave him her pots of collected money to keep, and they had a meeting time. And when she went to meet to get on the boat, that's the way you do it. You get on a smaller boat, goes to a bigger boat. He had left without her with all of the money. And it created such a rage in her, such an incredible rage. It even extended to that family, and she was obsessed in the days after. Why the rage? Well, because she was shamed. She felt like she had let down, I don't know, it was dozens of people in her extended family who had given up a lot to contribute to this fund. So she's had uncontrollable anger. And she tells the story of being on the way. I guess people were out of their homes, and she was on the way with some sort of flammable liquid to set a fire on home. Set a fire in the home, just desirous of pure revenge. And she had always been friends with the Zen priest, the small monastery up on the hill. And his position was such that he could always see the village. And he saw her go walking across. And what he did was, he rang the bell. Now that bell was a giant gong, I imagine. And I know it was only used on ceremonial occasions on a few days of the year. So it was extremely unusual and an alert for that to go off, for that to be set off or struck, for that bell to be struck on a day that was not a holiday. Well, she saw that and she looked up and she saw him, and it reorganized her thinking. And she gave up on that. She later left on another boat. This in itself is such a story, that these women who left Vietnam would carry suicide pills because they were so often raped and abused by the pirate-type people that were in the business of getting them out. They would get in desperate circumstances. Anyway, all this by way of saying that the bell is very important in many schools of meditation. And I was in a little class led by an enlightened leader, and he asked, "What is the bell?" And two things happened. I'm known not to necessarily go along with the flow of things. I just picked up the bell and rang it. Now, that, of course, was the answer. And it was, I don't even think it was very clever to think of that answer. But the thing that kind of worried me was that it upset the instructor. The instructor obviously did not have command over where he would put his mind. It kind of took the wind out of his whole lecture, but maybe it was an unthoughtful thing for me to do. But it just taught me that when you go into the meditation world, you're going to find, like everywhere else, everybody is imperfect. That's why I give the warnings at the beginning of this talk about my own imperfections and all that I may not understand. Really, it's up to you to find your own way and find your way around all the things that will be misleading in this world. Anyway, my approach was to read scores of books, develop a theory. My life was that of a scientist. Develop a theory and then test the theory. So the technique that I came up with from all this reading, talks, personal experiment, seemed to work for me. I quickly had the experience known as Kensho. That's like the first level of, it's a little bit of enlightenment. You're not deeply imbued with it. You have a moment of experience. It's transitory. It's not permanent. There's a bigger challenge to get Kensho to be more lasting in one's life and be continued as a more or less permanent characteristic. But it was interesting for me that my technique seemed to work, and I wondered if I've maybe found something, which is why I'm doing this video. I don't know what others will find. And I found that I could lower my pulse. I have various electronic devices, and I could lower my blood pressure. At least I could do that with no audience. I've often wondered if I had an audience, if I could ever do that. So Kensho is the first level of enlightenment, but it's passing, not sustained. And furthermore, you can't instantaneously activate it if you're in some life situation. So I'm not presenting what I have here as the ultimate solution to enlightenment. There's much more. So, you know, you would want to pursue schools and leaders who have a deep life experience and going much further than I chose to do. But the Kensho is a feeling and perception that one's not separate from the world. It's a feeling of sublime beauty of the world. You're overcome with emotion. Some people cry. And the idea is, the technique I used was one of, what I concluded was that all these meditative states, when they're most successful, come from the practitioner coaxing themselves to a position where they're trying for input only into the mind. Input only, no processing. This is the key idea that this podcast is leading to. Input only. Enter by the sound of the stream. So the technique used is to sit attentively, almost as if you heard something or something about to enter the room, and you open your mind to what's about to happen. And what you try for is keeping your mind in that state. So it's like, what's going to happen? Input only. No thinking, no processing. Input only. So, and what I found quickly is, as soon as I could sustain that technique, I began to have these very deep experiences. Now, this falsifies the idea that the benefits of meditation cannot be launched intellectually, because that's exactly what I did. Read hundreds of books, abstracted out the idea of input only, and tried it. It seemed to work a little bit. I haven't tried to take it further, but it's interesting what happened. You want to take all of that, as I emphasized earlier, with a grain of salt, and think for yourself about it. I would mention, though, that in my travels, I've met intellectually and in person some amazing people. There was a Zen Buddhist named Sun Sin Nim in Cambridge, Massachusetts, in Rhode Island. He came to the U.S. From a monastery in Korea, and he worked in a laundry in Rhode Island. This is what I mean about people who achieve the ability to put their mind where it will be most constructive. He had such charisma that over a period of years, he built first a small following, and then a larger following, and then a system of monasteries in many countries, and an actual international system. So he had natural charisma from enlightenment, and I think it's worth reflecting on what for him the life lessons were. First of all, he talked about it, an anecdote that I'll now tell you about. He would often go to groups of religious folks from different backgrounds, not just meditation, but Protestants, Catholics, whatever, Jewish folks, whatever. He remembers this one Protestant guy who prayed and prayed and prayed and prayed. And he was complaining because he always prayed to God, but God never seemed to speak back to him, which I guess is what many Christians wait for, is messages from God. And Sun Sin Nim said, well, I know what the problem there is, and that is God has been calling you, but the line is always busy. He used the analogy of a telephone. God is calling, but the line's always busy, so he can't get through. So this would be the idea of, once again, of input only, putting your mind where you are just taking in and not processing, not cogitating, not making distinctions, etc. Sun Sin Nim summarized this as don't know mind. You want to put yourself in don't know mind. You just sit there and you just don't know. So that's inspiring to me, because it seems to be, take the same approach or come to the same conclusion that I'm thinking that I came to. The other thing I'd say about Sun Tzu that's truly at the pinnacle of our American civilization is he came here and he did all of these things. And you ask people for what is love and what a definition of love is, and you will find a lot of misunderstanding. For many people, love is a feeling. That's not true all the time. But those with a more philosophical bent realize that love actually is also a set of actions, because if there are no actions, no one will ever know that the love is there. So Sun Tzu was asked, this is the last page of one of his fine books, was asked, what is love? And his definition I find quite beautiful. He said, love is, you ask me, I ask you. That's the definition. That's his definition of love. And I quite like it, because it also harmonizes with this idea that none of us has all the answers, and that the pursuit of understanding comes from opening your mind to whatever others have to say. How few people there are who actually listen to what others say. So I recommend Sun Tzu as someone worth reading. Zen meditation, though, it's also important to realize it'll always be funny. It'll always be humorous. Sun Tzu had a tremendous sense of humor. The issues, the pitfalls. Even Dalai Lama saying everything's an experiment, even Buddhism, is kind of comical for somebody that craves more hours just sitting and practicing. After this long life that he's had and all of his commitments, he just wants to sit and practice, but he considers it an experiment. You will find a lot of phoniness in the world of meditation, and as you will in many areas of life, many people who are just misguided and misguiding, and you have to watch out for possible adverse effects. So those are my thoughts on meditation. And the assignment that I would suggest after listening to all this is for you to think about it all and try to determine if I too am a phony. Well, thanks for listening. That's what I have on meditation.